This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer. I am very excited about today's episode because we are going to delve into something that Galactic Space Geek Jeff has always wanted to know more about, and our guest has that knowledge.
Oh, this is very curious. What is the problem that we're solving today?
How do you make a brain for a computer?
How do you make a brain for a computer? Okay, I raised my hand. I have always wondered this myself. So who's our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is the fantastic Lisa Linebaugh, who is a former electrical engineer turned mommy and children's author.
Oh, this sounds so much fun. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, we are so excited because, I mean, I am curious to learn about how you build a computer brain. You know, we all know computers. I mean, oh my gosh, we couldn't do anything without computers these days, right? But I don't know a lot about how to build them. So could you tell us, like, where do you start when you're trying to build something?
Well, it takes a lot of different kinds of people to make the microprocessor. So the microprocessor are like the brains of the computer.
Ooh, okay.
That's
okay.
The chip in the computer that when you type, it figures out what you mean and it does what you tell it to do. And so the first group of people that need to work on it are the architects. So when you have a new chip, like what does it need to do and what parts does it need inside of it and how do they connect?
Okay. That makes sense.
Then the next group of people, they actually take those drawings and they make the detailed electrical drawings. So what resistors, what transistors, what components actually need to be electrically active to make that work?
Okay. I can see that.
We take it another step and now we take that circuit design and now we have to see what it would look like, map it out in the materials that we're going to use to make it layer by layer by layer, 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 layer.
Oh my gosh, that sounds very complicated.
It's a very complicated process. And then the next step is where I used to work, is the process engineer. So we take those maps layer by layer and we actually physically make these things. Now, what's really interesting is the wires we're talking about are like thousands of the width of your hair.
They're oh my gosh.
They're so tiny, you cannot see them with your eyes. So it's super tiny. And why is it so tiny? Because the smaller it is, the faster your circuit will go and your Minecraft will load better.
Well, that's important, right?
Excellent connection. Wonderful. We have our listeners' attention now for sure. I have to ask the obvious question. If they can't be seen by the human eye, how are you working with them?
So the first thing I'll say is we start with a silicon wafer that you can see. That's a large pizza-sized wafer of silicon.
Oh, wow.
And silicon is a semiconductor. And a semiconductor will conduct electricity, but only sort of.
Oh, okay.
So the reason
the reason that it works so well for what we want to do is we can add impurities, which will add electrons in certain places that we can control the circuits in that silicon.
Okay.
So that's what's important about silicon. It has a special property. So we start out with the silicon platter, and we will make dozens to hundreds of chips on that one platter.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And each chip will have between millions and billions of little switches on it.
What?
How do you do that? How do you make that many switches?
So then we process the whole wafer as a whole, and at the end, you'll cut it all apart. But the way you process it is by thinking about it like, let's think about this whole wafer as a layer cake.
Okay.
Okay.
And so if we think about the platter that we're putting our cake on, that's our silicon layer.
Okay.
Okay. That makes sense.
And it's a super fancy cake. You know, it's got at least eight different layers. You know, and it's got a detailed pattern on the plate. and its recipe has over 300 steps, and it takes 1 to 2 months to make this cake. But
oh my gosh.
In the end, we cut this cake into dozens and hundreds of little pieces, and each piece is a working microprocessor in our cake.
Wow, okay.
They grow the silicon as a single crystal. So that's what's unique. The semiconductor has to be a beautiful single crystal of silicon, or it doesn't have good conducting semiconducting properties.
Is this the single crystal is the whole sheet?
They make it in a huge cylinder, like a big hot dog, which is a foot across, and they slice it into tiny thin wafers, like little pizzas that are a foot across and like hundredths of an inch thick.
Oh, wow.
And they polish it beautifully. And that's where we start with our cake platter. One of those, we call it a wafer.
Okay.
We start with that wafer. And the first thing we need to do is put a pattern on that wafer. And that pattern is going to be of electrons in certain places that we're going to need them to make these little transistor switches that we need.
Okay.
And then you might ask, how do we pattern something? It's actually a photographic process.
Oh, okay.
Except instead of film, we're using our wafer. And we put a photosensitive material on the whole wafer.
Okay.
Then we have what's called a mask. It's like a cutout of the design that we want to put on it, of where, where we want our metal lines.
Sure.
And so we shine light through this mask. And because it's so very tiny, we don't use normal light. We use deep ultraviolet light.
Oh.
We use ultraviolet light, so it's small enough. And we shine it on this material, which is light sensitive. And where the light hits the material, it kind of breaks it apart. So
we give
our layer a little bake, and then we rinse off, and all those places where the light hit will rinse away, and the parts that we didn't hit the light will be left behind. So that's called a photoresist. So that's how we've transferred our pattern from our map, basically, we had before, onto the physical, actual silicon wafer.
So is this the map that the architect drew originally?
Yes. Ooh. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Jen's happy she's following along.
It's all tied together.
I already have more information than I ever had about this process and how it works. But the way you're explaining it, I really think listeners can follow this. It almost sounds like, not to simplify it too far down, but like an arts and crafts project that a kid could imagine.
In some ways it is. If it just wasn't on such a minuscule, tiny scale.
Right. Sure.
You know, you can do this process at home, you know, with the right materials.
So what happens next?
So the next step, so now you've like put this pattern on it, but you haven't actually changed anything underneath. So what you need to do is etch into that layer underneath or put your pattern through in that layer you've exposed.
Okay.
If this is your very first step, what you're doing is you're adding extra electrons in those little places where you're making your transistors. If this is a metal layer, you're patterning all your wires, basically. Are going to be connected to the circuit.
Okay.
And use either a wet process with acids or a dry process by bombarding it with ions to knock out the particles. And very careful, because you only want to remove that one layer and nothing underneath. So once you've like got your platter finished, then you put on your first cake layer.
Wait, that's just the platter?
That's just the platter.
We're just getting started.
Okay. Oh my gosh.
And so there's generally at least 30 of these patterning steps to make your processor.
Wow.
Holy cow.
So that's just to get the silicon prepared, the bottom layer.
Okay. So you were going to tell us the first layer.
So then on top of that layer, you put an insulating layer, which in our model is like a cake layer. So now you put your first of many cake layers.
Okay.
And then you have to drill holes in that cake layer using this same patterning process.
Okay.
Where your metal connections will go down to the silicon.
Right.
You drill all these little connection holes. Then, after that's been done, you put your metal layer on. And the metal layer, you coat the whole wafer with metal.
All right.
Then you pattern it again. And the metal is kind of like your icing. So you have your insulating cake layer, your icing metal layer. And then you pattern your icing. That's all your wires that connect to different parts of the circuit. Then you put another insulating layer. Then you have to drill the holes so you can connect the wires above to the wires below.
Okay.
And then you put another metal layer of icing and you pattern
it. Wow.
And I was, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 layers of metal. So your cake has between 5 and 10 layers.
Okay. So at this point, how thick is our cake?
It's still small, right?
It's still very tiny. I think, you know, microns. You can't see it. So the way the way you have to look at this is with a scanning electron microscope to really see the structure.
Okay.
So how is all this done? I mean, I'm guessing this is not done by hand. This is done with machines?
This is done with machines. So it's done in a large factory that we call a fabrication facility. So we call it the fab.
Oh. Okay.
And the fab is a clean room, cleaner than any operating room.
Oh.
Because if we're talking about these wires that are 1/1000th the width of a human hair, any particle that size or bigger will get patterned onto the wafer and create a connection between two wires that shouldn't be there. And one particle can destroy one whole device.
Oh, wow.
If
it's in the wrong place. So particles are huge problem for making semiconductors because they're so small, anything from the outside. So to enter the clean room, there's a whole procedure and it takes about half an hour for a person to get in.
Oh my God.
Oh my.
You walk over a sticky pad to get extra stuff off your shoes. You
put on
little booties. These are only the first pair. Then you'd have a Gore-Tex suit from top to bottom, like a jumpsuit.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's called a bunny suit. I don't know why or where that comes from.
You don't have ears, but it's just
not
a bunny suit.
But everybody wears a bunny suit. And once you get your jumper on, then you pull your real booties on over. And this is all made of Gore-Tex.
Oh, wow.
And then you have gloves for your hands. So you have a net over your hair.
Right.
And then a hood over your head that only shows your face.
Okay.
Okay.
And then you have a shield that you breathe into and a filter on your waist pack. Because your breath is too dirty for the environment.
Oh my gosh.
You breathe the clean room air because it's super clean, good air, but your breath has to be filtered before it's allowed back into the environment.
Right.
Oh my gosh. So,
wow.
Are you hot in this? I mean, I'm just thinking Gore-Tex can be.
They keep the room cold. They keep the clean room pretty cold.
Okay.
And so I'm still in the changing room, right? The next step is you go in this, it's called an air shower. So you go in this little room,
an
airlock. A door closes on each side.
Right.
You put up your arms and the air blows down on you to hopefully like knock any environmental particles off of you.
So this is like a super duper TSA pre-TSA check, right?
Exactly.
You have to like put your arms up and stand still.
Except you're closed in this room. And then the door enters and you can go in the clean room. And in the clean room, the ceiling is grated and there's a constant airflow down from the ceiling and the floor has holes in it. It goes straight through the floor. So there's a constant positive airflow from the ceiling to the floor to also control. Ah.
So it doesn't recirculate at all.
Well, it just goes back then behind where all the machines are in a different area. So the machines face into the room where we're working and then the air goes into that back room and then goes back up because the machine part, the wafers aren't in that environment as much. You don't have to to the same degree of cleanliness.
And all this is to avoid one tiny extra little particle. Holy cow. That's very specific.
Okay. Wow. You said your clean room is cleaner than any operating room on Earth. Is a clean room for microchip building the cleanest place on Earth?
That is a good question. I think that depends on like how small your technology is. Smaller and smaller you're trying to work, the cleaner and cleaner. And the cleanest environments these days actually use a lot of robotics. So now they have the wafers in a sealed environment.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So then the people don't have to be in as clean of environment if the wafers are in their own clean environment. It's even cleaner.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
But I think semiconductor processing is one of the more complicated processing environments. And so particles are just one of the largest issues.
I have a whole new appreciation for my phone and my laptop right now. Right. I'm going to treat them with care and I'm going to dust them off. I'm getting a can of air later today. Oh my gosh. I had no idea. It was quite like I've seen the inside workings of a computer before, but I suppose I've never really put the thought into the building of the pieces of what goes inside the machine. So
there's another whole step that once we finish this whole wafer every device on the wafer is tested.
Okay, sure.
If it doesn't work, they put an ugly ink blot right in the middle of it. But then they slice it up with lasers.
Okay.
Squares. So each square is its own microprocessor, and the ones that are good get packaged. So you have to connect to the outside world. All those little tiny wires of the microprocessor have to be connected to the legs on the chip that goes in your computer so your computer can talk to it.
Sure.
So okay.
There's a testing step, a packaging step, another testing step. But in the process of packaging, they seal it all up. So once it's packaged, particles are no longer a problem.
Okay.
How big is it by now then? Because, you know, like some of us, like if you've taken a computer apart, you can see and kind of hold the chip. It's not that big, but I'm assuming you've put enough layers on now that it's big enough that you can see.
You can't see the working parts, but you can see the packaging. If you look really close, some of them have a little window. You can see the little wires. They're like hair thin that connect from the outside. And as you go up the layers of the cake, your wires have to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Okay.
You have to it has to just grow as you like build it out.
Okay. That makes sense.
Once you've finished it, it's, you know, a little bit bigger than a thumbnail generally, if it's a microprocessor. Some of them might be a little bit bigger. And each of those does have a million to a billion parts on it.
Oh gosh.
My.
It's packed.
Okay. So mentioning the size and mentioning how much, without going into how many computations and things like that, I think all the way down to kids, we kind of all know those stories of, oh, your laptops are so small now, or your computers are so small. I work in a space museum, and I love pointing out that a mom and a kid's cell phone has more processing power than all of NASA had when we sent astronauts to the moon. Give me the simplified, so my brain understands it, version of how has that happened so rapidly? How have we made them so much better?
I think a lot of it's just that research and engineering, that you make it smaller, the next generation smaller, smaller, smaller. The smaller it is, the faster it will be, because the speed of electricity, you know, it has a distance to go. And the other problem can be is power management. If it runs too much power, it gets too hot. Then you have to add a fan and all this. And so the newer technologies have somehow solved that problem.
Nice.
I don't know all the details, but they can run on such low power, your laptop will not need a fan. So that also makes it slimmer.
Yes.
Okay.
I've noticed that, because the laptops, they're not as heavy as they used to be. And also I remember, I've kept some of my old ones because I have some of my stories or whatever on them. And when I plug the old one in, you'll hear them. You know, the whirring of the fan. I'll be like, oh, and I don't hear that on my new laptop. It also takes a lot longer for the old one to kind of come up, right? It takes longer to process and wake up and all that kind of stuff.
This is a little bit out of what I used to do, but the architecture. So back to that first step, what do you put on this piece of silicon? Well, nowadays, because they can have so many transistors on one, they can put the graphics processor on it too. And now if you don't have to go out to wires and back to another chip, it's even faster. So now if they're on the same actual piece of silicon, now their connections are even faster.
Okay.
And the memory, it's faster. So the more that you have on that one piece of silicon, the distances are tiny, the connections are shorter. It just, the speed goes up and up. But it's all just being, you know, driven by the engineering changes, step by step by step.
Very cool. Okay, so I have to ask, you have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, both in electrical engineering. Did you know that you wanted to work on building microprocessors? Like, were you a computer geek from way back?
Well, I go so far back that the computers were just really becoming something you could access when I was in high school.
Yep.
Okay.
When I went to college, it still wasn't something you would own. You would go to the lab at the school and have to work on their computer.
Okay.
But they were Macs, early Macs. But I came at semiconductor engineering, not so much. I liked engineering, what I knew about it. I liked math, but what I really liked, I loved crystals.
Oh.
I used to collect rocks.
That's and then how you came.
I noticed that rocks have crystals. And then I started to collect actual crystal specimens. Mineral shows. And I got fascinated because the structure of the crystal is all dependent on the atoms, how the atoms stack inside.
Yep.
So you look at the outside of the crystal and it tells you something about the internal structure And how can that crystal be an octagon? Like, how does it know to do that? I just thought that was amazing.
It is. Having written several rock books, I asked the same thing because I come at it from an engineering point of view. But I think it's intriguing that you got to where you are by loving rocks. That's not what we expected, right, Jeff?
Not even close.
Yeah, I think that that's cool because that shows kids or people of all ages that there's no direct path. You could come at science and engineering from any way that intrigues you.
Yeah, my dad used to take me out just to, you know, where they'd done construction and disturbed the ground and all the rocks were just sitting out and just collecting rocks and in streams and just learning from that piece by piece. And then in high school, realizing that semiconductor is a crystal and it's a crystal that conducts electricity. And so to work with these crystals, you need to go at it from an electrical engineering standpoint.
What an awesome thing for our listeners to hear, because I have a 10-year-old daughter and she actually loves one of Jen's rock books. She brings it outside and she picks up rocks and looks it up to make the connection from, you know what? I'm just a kid that loves rocks and crystals and things that I find that make me curious and make me ask questions. That can lead to working for some of the biggest companies doing the most high-tech stuff from a rock, literally. That is really cool.
There's like a second layer of coolness in grad school that I worked on a project where you use crystals with lasers.
And what did you do there?
So you can change the frequency of the laser. So you put in like a lower frequency, it goes through this crystal, it comes at a higher frequency. So for semiconductor processing, they're always trying to find the right frequency for the size they're trying to make. And so using some of the lasers that were available, how do you get the frequency higher? More blue.
Wow.
And so there is,
crystals are just amazing.
And there is so much science behind many, many layers down of science in this. So in the introduction, I also mentioned that you are working on being a children's author. I have to ask, is there science in the stories that you're writing?
Every story.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I also write fiction stories. I like to write for middle grade.
Okay.
But even in a fiction story, I like to put the science in. So maybe it's a girl. She turns herself, a little bit of magic involved, into a dragonfly.
Well,
what based on science do we know? How does a dragonfly perceive the world and what is different? And then I have a story about a self-driving car. And there's a question. It becomes friends with a parrot. So the question of where is consciousness? Can a car AI be conscious? Can a parrot cross over into that? What happens when you've got the biological and the AI and they connect and humans don't really see either one as conscious? So just exploring that in a story, mainly it's about the adventures they have together, but underlying it is this fun idea to think about.
I think that's intriguing, especially that, you know, we're talking about AI. So where does, I don't know if you know much about AI or whatever, but I assume all of that is based on microprocessing too. They just have to get really, really, really small and then probably have tons of them, I'm guessing. So you hook them all together. Is that how like really complex computing works?
It's got like different components. So one component is the processing power.
Okay.
That you think how many neurons are in a human brain? There's like 86 billion, roughly.
Right.
86 billion neurons in a human brain. And so now that chips are getting to the point where they're in the tens of billions, or they're like 10 billion, it's interesting, you know, how it's getting like close to the same capacity. But the other part is how is the software written? So how do you use this computing? So that's the neural networks. So there's that whole other side of software where they design the way they give it information that it can learn from. So these networks are learning from different data sets, but they have the fast computing power so they can do more and more iterations on that learning, do it faster. So it is converging. Wow. It'd be interesting to see in the next, you know, couple of 10 years, like where we end up.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they're making, you know, things are happening by leaps and bounds in the artificial intelligence world. It's wild. I mean, you know, so my first computer, we at the Naval Academy in my class, we were the very first class to be issued computers, and we got a Zenith 248K.
Woo!
kilobytes, right? Like K. I mean, my cell phone is probably what, I don't know, a million times faster than that thing. Plus it was as big as our desks. Like it was huge.
That's amazing.
I mean, so you think about this, and this was what, 30 some years ago, how small and fast things have gotten just in that span of time. It's incredible.
Yeah. And it doesn't show signs of slowing down yet.
No, it doesn't.
So that leads me to ask the question, the very, very important question for our listeners. From a former semiconductor engineer, is the robot takeover coming?
Well, I think not, but I think that...
Okay, I can breathe again.
Good answer.
The programs have to write the programs in a way that prevents that. It's not.
I like that addition to the answer.
It's not such a hardware part. It's like, what do you do with your capability?
Or what should you do with your capability?
Right.
That leads us back to the self-driving cars. We had one of our previous engineers that was on who she makes self-driving cars. And that was one of the questions she actually brought up was, should we have self-driving cars everywhere, all over the US or wherever, all over the countries? And how would these work? So I think it's intriguing when the people that are actually creating the technology stop for a minute and ask themselves those questions. Should we do it? And how do we do it responsibly? And all those kind of things. Those are probably important questions to ask.
Yeah, those are definitely important to think about the ramifications.
That is really cool. And aside from the fact that I'm really going to take care of my phone and my computer now, because I have that much more respect for what's inside of it, my brain just got opened up to what my daughter's future is going to be like, because she's only 10 now. And I can think of my life from 10 to my current age. But what is hers going to be like if they continue to increase processing power and make thinner and faster, as you were talking about? So this leads me, we do ask all of our guests to bring a challenge with them. And because we've talked about such complex things, it really makes me curious. Do you have a challenge for our listeners?
Well, it's a challenge in activity, I guess.
Going back, excellent.
The fundamental part of what a silicon wafer is a crystal.
Okay.
So you can grow crystals at home. You can't use the molten metal. I'm sorry. I know. My kids are 13 and 16. They would like to try that. But you can use a water solution and grow crystals out of simple materials like salts and sugar.
Okay.
That sounds fun.
And it's really fun to see the different ways that you can do that.
So our listeners can grow crystals without having to buy a kit?
You can. Oh yeah, it's quite simple. You can just read about how to make, you make a solution where you use a little bit of warm water. You might need a grown-up to help you. You put the right amount of water compared to, let's say, salt, and dissolve the salt. And if you heat the solution, so when the salt dissolves, it's called the solution. You don't have any bits of salt.
Right. Then
what you're doing is you're super saturating it. So you're heating it to the point where you put more salt into the water than it really wants to have. And so when you cool it, the salt wants to come out, but it comes out slowly enough, it will crystallize. And you need to put a string with a little thing on the end. Yep. And you'll get the crystals will grow on it. You can do this with sugar as well and make
wonderful.
It's called rock candy. You've probably seen that at the store. And
it also is good. Yeah.
Yeah. You might break your teeth on it, but usually when you buy it, they've added color afterwards. But when you grow the crystal, it'll just be the same color as
the sugar,
transparent sugar. And both salt and sugar grow in cubes, which is really cool.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds fun. So I hope a lot of our listeners are going to do that. I've done this before. I've also done it with my kids. I think that was probably an early science experiment they had to do for their science classes. It's definitely fun to do. And like you said, it's just so cool to see how the crystals come out, how they stack one on each other and all. And sometimes, you know, because they don't look like symmetricalness. Sometimes they come out in like weird angles and all this kind of stuff. You could do it several times and you could have different looking crystals every time.
And if you want to make like a really, really big crystal, you can grow, it's called a seed crystal. You grow one really small, perfect crystal and you tie that and then in your solution. So now your crystal has a place to grow and it will continue that form. If you just have a string, it's like Jen said, it'll tend to start growing here, and this one will grow here, and that one will go there.
Yeah, okay.
Be all over the place. But if you can kind of experiment with it. If you cool it faster, what happens? If you cool it slower, what happens?
Yeah.
Jen, did you catch that?
Yes.
After talking about all the layers in the microprocessor, Miss Lisa just brought a challenge that has layers.
There you go.
Because now kids can grow a starter crystal and use that to grow a bigger crystal.
Yes. Well, I mean, this has been so fabulous. I learned so much about computer brains. My own brain is like exploding with all of this. So thank you so much for being on Solve for Kids, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun today.
Wasn't that a deep dive into how computers are made and what is going on inside? That is exactly what I was hoping we were going to learn today, Jen.
Yeah, that was so fascinating. And I mean, it's really funny. All I could think about was my very first computer all those years ago. Right? And,
yes.
And now how they look so different.
So different and so much smaller, and how they've been able to pack so much into our phones and computers so they can do so much more.
It's mind-boggling to me, especially with all the layers that you have to build and all this wafer. And I would love to go see this, although you'd have to put on that suit and all this kind of stuff. So maybe they wouldn't let
us. And what a great challenge she brought for our listeners on crystal growing. I am sure some of our listeners have grown a crystal before, but if you go out and get yourself another crystal kit, ask mom and dad, of course, but watch it grow while you're thinking of this episode and how your computer is grown in the same way, you're going to think about it a whole lot differently.
Oh, I agree. And I hope that some of you will share your crystals or your ideas about the show with us. Be sure to find us on social media. We are at KidSolve at Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And don't forget, you can go to our website, solveitforkids.com, and learn more about Lisa. And we're going to put some cool videos up there, too, about computers.
I can't wait to see those myself. And listen for us next time on Solve It for Kids!